Trying to hold you down, though the fear within my heart still lingers round. Darling, I am hoping to see your face every Sunday morning in my embrace. And though the fear within my heart still drives me over the edge, it is you that I want to hold me in bed. Should the sun shine tomorrow, I'll be holding my head, 'cause I'll be hoping for raindrops instead. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. I've been hoping for clouds, but the sun remains. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. Heaven sent me your love, but it keeps me chained. Darling, I was searching for the light within, when you came on in place my world in spin. I was aching when you came around. Funny how things work, how my world was upside down. And though the fear in my heart still drives me over the edge, it is you that I want to hold me in bed. Should the sun shine tomorrow, I'll be holding my hand, 'cause I'll be hoping for raindrops instead. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. I've been hoping for clouds, but the stars remain. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. Heaven sent me your love, but it keeps me chained. I'll bide my time, I will wait patiently for the day. When the clouds are dark, the skies are red, to feel your love over me. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. I've been hoping for clouds, but the sun remains. Fresh roses in my garden need the rain. Heaven sent me your love, but it keeps me chained. Thank you.
wonder would you mind if I talk to you for a minute? I want to talk about this woman of mine. She always complaining about me never being at home. But when I'm there, she's starving. Listen to me now. She don't make no rice. She don't cook no beans. She ain't frying no chicken. I can't get no collard greens. She ain't making no eggs. I can't get no toast. She ain't frying no bacon. And she sure ain't cooking no roast. But she's the magic woman. She got legs and thighs. She got them cakes, but she sure ain't making no pies. She's the magic woman.
Highly recommend that you do study country music history and realize that there was a lot of African Americans that trained a lot of these early country singers, and they learned how to play from them. It's beyond political parties. It's beyond sponsorship and money. These are human rights. Times that I've gone to concerts and sang at these events, and people were waving the Confederate flag. And there were times that I was called the N-word at these same concerts. This book, Black Like Me, but back in college. It's written by a guy named John Howard Griffin. Went to the Deep South to see what it was like to be a black man in the 1960s. And I had this song title, and I was like, guys, this is gonna sound crazy, but I have a song title and hear me out. I said, it's called Black Like Me. And I remember we finished it, and Nathan Chapman, one of the writers, said, I think we wrote just one of the most important songs of your career, and it could make some people very mad. I highly recommend that you do study country music history and really see where it's coming from.
The banjo was an emblem of Black America for a long time before whites ever picked it up. You know, the idea that it was, you know, created in the Caribbean by Africans that had been brought over from Africa and enslaved, and that it is a part of, it came out of that culture, but there are all these ancestral instruments that came before that are West African, and then it goes up into North America with enslaved people and becomes a part of the landscape and becomes a part of Black America. When you talk about fiddle music, string band music, banjo music, square dancing, which, you know, square dance calling is such a piece of American culture, and that was invented, you know, most likely by African Americans. It represents the history of America, which has been this interaction between European and African, between Western and Eastern, between all these different cultures coming in. At the same time, you have this sort of white supremacist rewrite of the narrative of this music, and so the recording industry sort of cements a lot of what's going on. What's recorded is remembered a lot of the times, you know, and all those Black musicians who would have been playing string band music at that time even are forgotten because they didn't get recorded. So it's really frustrating because you have people saying, like, Lil Nas X wearing a cowboy hat, oh, that's cultural appropriation. I'm like, yo, it's so unbelievably frustrating when a white person says that, because I'm like, you so clearly don't know even your own history. And whose fault is that?
Say something. It's not a political stance. This is a human right, basic human stance. It doesn't mean that everybody else's lives don't matter. It's just saying that Black lives matter too. Country music is not just an accent, it's an actual way of life, and that's how I live my life.
Still, I gotta go now, so consistency. I like it. I like it.
He was one of the first solo stars of the Grand Ole Opry.
When I heard that music, boy, I get chills.
On stage, country music fans adored DeFord Bailey's black hillbilly sound. Off stage, he wasn't allowed to eat, sleep, or socialize with his fellow performers and fans.
He almost caught pneumonia sleeping in cars because he was a color boy.
At the height of his career, he vanished from the spotlight. DeFord Bailey, a legend lost.
Presenting the Grand Ole Opry, let her go, boys.
A generation before America credited Charlie Pride with breaking the color barrier in country music, black listeners across the South were not only tuning into country, but tuning up to play along. The very first solo star in the footlights of the Grand Ole Opry stage was a frail, disabled black man from Smith County, Tennessee.
And now, friends, we introduce our little mascot, DeFord Bailey, with his harmonica.
Nicknamed the Harmonica Wizard, DeFord Bailey took no credit for his unique sound and role in history. He simply said it was a blessing from above that came by way of a curse. His mother died before he turned one, and soon another tragedy would strike.
Father had polio at 3 years old, and they thought he would never walk. And he could move only his arms. He was given this harmonica to play with.
And he was lying in a bed for the entire year, and the way that he was able to entertain himself was making music. There was nothing that he saw or heard that he didn't think about the musical qualities in that.
I pick up everything I hear around me. I'm just like a microphone. Cow, chicken, dog, they got music in them, all of them.
These rural sounds became a trademark in DeFord's music. While sick, his widowed father couldn't care for him. An aunt stepped in to try and save his life.
She started looking for ways that she needed to do things to make him more limber. They took owls because owls can move their head around, and so she thought maybe this would help. You know, they would kill an owl and take the oil from the owl and treat him with that. Everything that they could think of that might help.
Her persistence paid off. DeFord survived the polio, though it left its mark. A permanent limp, hunchback, and stunted growth. Even as an adult, he measured just 4'11" and weighed less than 100 pounds.
He didn't think it was just an accident that he had had polio. If he had been physically active and able to get out and play ball like other kids, that he would not have spent that time working on his music.
If I don't blow my heart, I hurt. God put that on me, make me play. If I was in a place where I couldn't play, he showed me how to stop the pain by moving my mouth like I was playing.
For DeFord Bailey, music was not only a physical need, but a birthright.
all of his family was musical. His natural parents, his foster parents, his uncles, his aunts, his grandfather who had been a slave. He was a champion fiddler. We're talking about a family of musicians. And Dee Ford was born into that. He benefited from it. His best memories as a kid are of the nights when the folks would get together and make music.
The Baileys could play a harp, a banjo, all string music. We were known from slavery times as the best musician.
At the turn of the century, there were black string bands all over Tennessee, and in fact all over the South. It's not surprising because in the slavery days, a talented musician was taught to play the fiddle so he could entertain at plantation dances. After emancipation, many of these fiddlers kept their instruments, developed their own fiddling styles and their own battery of tunes, and created an entire tradition of fiddle and banjo music.
Long after his fiddler grandfather was gone, Dee Ford continued his musical tradition in his own play. He was also part of a growing trend. All over the South, fiddle licks were being replaced by the howl of a harmonica. Firmly grounded in his musical roots, Dee Ford would create a sound all his own.
He had incredible range, very fast, a lot of trills, a lot of vocal effects. So it was really very innovative, I think very far-reaching and very visionary.
A vision he developed first with his ears, not his eyes. He captured the sound of a moving train years before he ever saw one. As a teenager, he perfected his sound by hiding under the trestle as the train went by.
I would get up under it, put my hands over my eyes, listen to the sound, then play that sound all the way to school.
At 19, he rode the train into Nashville's Union Station. His feet didn't even touch the floor. When the conductor insisted he buy a child's ticket, he protested. It signaled the beginning of a lifelong battle to overcome many obstacles, based solely on his physical appearance.
In 1918, when he moved to Nashville, it was a big city. I mean, he had always lived in small communities. He'd lived in these little farms around Tennessee. And then here he is in a big, thriving city, and it was exciting for him.
He heard Louis Armstrong play. And he got exposed to all kinds of other music.
Music he used to create a new style of playing that won him a regular spot on Nashville's WDAD, the radio station broadcast up the street from WSM Studios.
He was playing the harmonica on his job, and Dr. Herman Bates heard him and said, why don't you come upstairs and play for us? He said, oh, no, they got some shiny horns. That's what he talked, you know, very comical. And my little heart wouldn't do anything.
Dr. Bate disagreed and insisted Dee Ford join his band, the Possum Hunters, on the new WSM Saturday Night Barn Dance Radio Show. His daughter, Alcyon, was in the band.
Dee Ford started right in with Daddy and Mr. Hayes. Who is this? Dex's nephew. Judge said, don't question me about this boy. And Mr. Hayes says, well, Doc, he can't go on the hell without an audition. Daddy says, Judge, I will stake my reputation on the ability of this boy. And he went on the air without an audition. And Mr. Hayes heard him play these first few bars, and he just knocked him out. He just threw his whistle down on the floor. That's an actual fact.
Once he heard the quality of that music, there was no going back. This was not tokenism, this was not any effort to integrate, this was purely the fact that he knew he had a draw. He had someone who could help build the show.
Unlike anybody else on the Grand Ole Opry at that time, when Dee Ford came out to perform, it was just him. He just went out there, climbed up on that little Coca-Cola carton in front of the microphone, and just played the daylights out of that harmonica. And he would do that for 15 minutes at every show.
It was so distinctive, it was so individualistic, and it was so different from everything that was out there. He was doing things technically that people didn't think were possible on his instrument at that time.
His technical abilities also inspired the idea for one of the most famous and enduring names in country music. One night in 1927, the NBC Studios opera show signed off playing a classical piece of music imitating a modern locomotive. As a segue to local acts on WSM, Judge Hay introduced D. Ford Bailey and his Pan American Blues.
And after D. Ford's performance, Judge Hay said, "For the past hour, we've been listening to music taken largely from grand opera. And from now on, we'll present the grand old opera."
Ooh, opera, let her go, boys.
Every Saturday night, the line, rain, snow, sleet, or hail, they were there to hear D. Ford Bailey. It was unbelievable. That little guy can't take a little instrument or draw a big crowd.
I can still hear Daddy play the Fox Chase and the Pan American when the sophomore judge would say, "Now we'll bring on D. Ford Bailey." And that's when we would all start hollering. We used to come in when we was babies and hear the wonderful music that the people played. And then see a little bitty man come out on the stage with a blue coat on and a cap on and white pants.
My dad talks about how he didn't want to miss a single Saturday night because he wanted to hear the Opry, but he particularly wanted to hear D. Ford Bailey.
D. Ford was probably the most influential harmonica player in the South for about 30 years. Today, almost any harmonica player, either directly or indirectly, can be traced back to D. Ford's playing. In the early days of the Grand Ole Opry, it wasn't completely unheard of for African-American performers to be on the show. What was unusual, that they would emerge as stars of the magnitude that D. Ford was.
But he was a star that was heard, not seen.
D. Ford Bailey, and it'll be his famous Fox Chase. All right, D. Ford.
Many believe that's how D. Ford remained a favorite act on the opera stage.
You know, he was not on display a lot, so they didn't know whether he was black or white.
He could probably never have been on the Grand Ole Opry had it been televised initially. There was a strong fear that people, as they were knitting and listening to the Grand Ole Opry on Friday night, somehow they would say, "We're not going to listen to that because a black man is playing an harmonica."
They did not advertise on the Opry that he was black. Some of the depictions that I've seen show him as a little boy on a bicycle. So clearly the audience knew that he was a small person and they assumed very young, but there was not an intentional effort to promote the fact that he was black.
Ironically, as D. Ford's music was growing in popularity, its roots were dying.
What happened to black hillbilly music, as D. Ford called it, was really kind of tragic. It didn't die out of its own accord. When the record companies began recording Southern music in the 1920s, they themselves segregated the music into white and black series. Because of this artificial segregation that existed in the record companies, the black string bands were virtually ignored, and gradually the younger musicians that would have been carrying on the tradition moved into blues or gospel music.
The fact of the matter is that black people have always listened to white people's music, and white people have always listened to black people's music. And that the fear has been more on the people who control the industry than anything else.
If you look at some of the greatest names in the Country Music Hall of Fame, the Carter family, Bill Monroe, Hank Williams, each one of these people learned directly from an African-American musician. Not just indirectly, not from records. They actually had a mentor who sat down with them and showed them how to do things.
Dee Ford Bailey was the first African-American musician who was not just a mentor, but a maverick in the country music genre. For a short time, he defied the industry standard and successfully shared his musical tradition with a mostly white audience.
He would have been a reverse Elvis, if you want to put it that way. I think that we would have seen him as a bridge between black music and white music, particularly with regards to country.
He tried to enlarge the scope of country music and to bring into it blues, gospel music, novelty songs, and popular music. And this was long before the idea of a crossover hit had even crossed anybody's mind.
People respond to greatness. They don't necessarily care where the greatness came from, what the greatness looks like. And people could inherently sense that this was somebody who was a once-in-a-lifetime performer, somebody who was great. This was somebody who they were privileged to see.
In the 1930s, they got their chance when the Opry went out on the road.
To show how popular Dee Ford was, every new group that came to the Opry took Dee Ford Bailey with them out on the road. They took him out to draw their crowds. All the new shows, Bill Monroe, Roy Acuff.
I was an unknown, and Dee Ford traveled with me for a long time and helped me to become known to the Grand Ole Opry audiences. And I've always had a great friendship for Dee Ford for being humble as he was and to help me. He helped me to get to where I am.
The touring in itself was hard, back-breaking work. They would spend hours and hours driving to a show, do the show, pile back into the car, try to get some sleep on the way to the next show, and they would do this all week long and then have to get back to Nashville on Saturday night to play the Grand Ole Opry. In addition to that, Dee Ford had the added problem that he was black.
It was incredibly difficult for Dee Ford Bailey to travel around the South with a group of white performers in the 1930s. I mean, you're talking about the heyday of Jim Crow. And this guy was able to travel around the South, but he did it at a price. He could not go in any of the restaurants and eat with the other performers.
If they played on stage and they had to break another 2 or 3 hours, he couldn't go anywhere but stay behind the stage and wait.
Sleeping was even worse. He actually carried his own army blanket with him so that if he had to sleep in the car, he could crack the window and at least keep reasonably warm in the car.
I remember Roy Acuff telling me that he actually put my dad in a trunk and carried him up the service elevator to get him up to the room.
Uncle Dave Macon used to go into a hotel and basically say, Dee Ford is my valet. He needs to come into my room with me so he can have my suits ready to go and have my breakfast served and so on and so forth.
He conformed to the social mores and the laws of society at that point. It was a simple matter. If he were going to perform, he had to make those accommodations. And he did it, and he never complained about it.
He didn't worry about it. He was playing his harmonica, something he loved. He didn't realize this is what I have to do. I have to stay here until the next show. I'm ready for the next show.
But in 1941, there was no next show for Dee Ford Bailey.
At the height of his abilities as a musician, all of a sudden, wham, Dee Ford vanishes from the Grand Ole Opry. It's been investigated for years, and there are several reasons that could be very likely. Dee Ford got caught up in the fight between ASCAP and BMI.
You had an intense rivalry as BMI was formed and was competing, trying to assert itself against the more traditional ASCAP. The WSM people would not let Dee Ford play or any of the other Opry performers play any of the tunes that had been licensed by ASCAP.
Because ASCAP was charging double to play their songs on the radio, almost all traditional music, including Dee Ford's repertoire, was blacklisted. WSM executives insisted their shows play only new BMI tunes. These tunes were less expensive to license, and the station's management had a financial investment in the newly formed BMI.
Eventually, the story was put out that Dee Ford wouldn't learn any new tunes, which meant he wouldn't learn any BMI tunes, and therefore he was let go. That doesn't exactly sound quite right to me, because nobody else was let go at the time because they wouldn't learn new tunes.
In fact, Dee Ford Bailey knew many more tunes than the Opry allowed him to play. In addition to the harp, he also played the guitar, the fiddle, and the banjo.
I could have been a better musician, but I was handicapped. Back in those times, I was the wrong color to get anywhere. I couldn't grow. If they let me play like I wanted, I could have stole the show. They had me down. I wasn't free.
If you look back at that particular era in time, it's hard for me to believe that a otherwise all-white cast looked at this one male African-American who was enormously popular, and everybody just jumped up and down and said, this is wonderful, this is great, this is a step forward. I don't think there's any question that race played a part of it.
Dee Ford's old-fashioned style may have also played a part in him leaving.
He was one of the first victims of the music's own commercial success. As the music started becoming more professional, more slick, more appealing to a general audience, it tended to turn its back on its roots.
They turned me loose with a wife and kids to root hog or die. They got the good out of me and turned me loose. Sometimes I wish I'd never heard of WSM.
He went right along with it all those years. And how you had to eat, somebody bringing you a sandwich before they could get it to you, it's cold. Or they were bringing you a bowl of soup before it got to you, it was cold. And then when they asked him to change his music, then that's when he said, well, they threw with me, they don't want me anymore. That's how he felt.
I think that Dee Ford Bailey, as much as he loved the music and wanted to perform, even he couldn't take some of the stuff that was being dished out to him. He said, look, I will always play. You will be at a loss for me. You may not recognize it now, but years later, your people will still be talking about me because it's unfinished business in the musical industry.
Essentially, it's a mystery. After over 50 years, hardly anybody's around today who can speak about it firsthand. There are all kinds of rumors, there are all kinds of theories, but the simple fact is that Dee Ford left. It's one of the great tragedies of American music.
After leaving the show, Dee Ford spent the rest of his life running a shoeshine parlor only a few blocks away from the famous Opry stage. He created his own stage using everyday life as a backdrop.
His attitude is he could keep playing his music and enjoying his music, and you know, whether he performed publicly or not was not the major thing with him. He was perfectly content to play to four walls and to God.
This harp has kept me places money wouldn't start to and brought me back. It's worth $1 million just to have him play around on.
He loved his music. I don't think he missed a day for any. But himself or for someone to walk up and say, hey, D, play me a tune. He always carried his harmonica every day, everywhere he would go. He never was in a hurry. He started to work, then he would stop playing the harmonica. All up and down 12th Avenue. He may start to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. He would probably get to the shop by 12.
What a wonderful man this man has made, a legend, but almost disappeared. in a way, he did disappear.
We lost him there for 25 years. It was kind of like if Ernest Hemingway had suddenly decided to stop writing and go open up a bar in Key West. Yeah, I suppose, you know, he makes a living at it, but golly, all the great work that he could have done. And that's the way I feel about Dee Ford today.
Dee Ford's legacy includes only a few recordings, most captured in the last few years of his life by friend David Morton.
When I heard that music, boy, I get chills. I mean, tremendous. D4's music was just absolutely incredible. You heard him and you felt like you were in the presence of a master.
Racism makes ignorant people out of all of us if we don't know history. And I think D4 Bailey's memory is a victim of that.
What we have to do is stop thinking of it in terms of country music and blues and rock and roll. It's all one music. It's American music. It's roots music. And Dee Ford was one of the people who best exemplified this wonderful melting pot mixture.
I think Dee Ford Bailey haunts the country industry right now at the level of trying to make the industry view itself holistically rather than partially. If he remains a footnote in history, then a similar crime would be to put Benny Goodman, a white jazz player, as a footnote in jazz history. You can't do that. He's more than a footnote.
He was one of the first great innovators. Louis Armstrong, B.B. King, Elvis Presley. These are all people who have taken an older music and made it new again. And Dee Ford tried to do that. And he did it very well, but he wasn't allowed to finish his job.
In 1967, Dee Ford Bailey was invited back to play the Opry stage. He would play that stage only four more times before his death in 1982.
Sometimes I feel like crying, jealous again. I got the blues, but I don't know what to do.
I wanna be on your mind. This is 1-to-1 on WRCT Pittsburgh.
8 Strand will be your PH Strand show.
On the radio long day, play DJ, they're the play every day. Ding, where the music everyone. Yeah, what was that yesterday?
Yes, man.
Right now, I saw me driving to the studio scene. I'm on the Shantarai. Yes, you're seeing the sister for the bridge. Yeah.
Ding, where the music everyone. Where? Tune in to the AJ show. Yeah. Tune in, Kevin Hammond's on the go.
AJ show, man. With a special request to the brothers out there, yeah. What was it, Kevin?
Wow!
Lively
stuff. Wow!
Special request.
Red, gold, and green.